Welcome to the Lights Out Podcast. This is Chris Lights Out Lytle, and this is our journey to document the history of mixed martial arts. I have brought with me my friend, the MMA detective Mike Davis, and together we will preserve the history and hear some great stories from the world in the era of the no holds barred. Thank you and enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a very special guest today on the Lights Out Podcast. We've got Gerald Strieben. Gerald, first and foremost, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. It's good to be here.
Well, you haven't done an interview in years.
Mm-mm.
You're pretty kind of, well, I'd like to say you're kind of off the radar, but with people that have questions about you, you've got no problem posting your phone number and your address online.
Yeah, I know. I have no problem. I'm up in the mountains in Oregon. I'm kind of underground right now, but I don't have any problem with people knowing where I'm at. But, you know, all my stuff seems to be 20 years old. People don't seem to be interested, you know, in that, those old stories anymore. I'm 40, almost 45 years old now. This was when I was 22. You
know? Right. Right. So is there anything off the table in this interview?
No, I don't, you know, I am what I am. I've got nothing to hide, and I remember everything exactly how it happened, and I've got a pretty good memory. So I, you know, you can't really throw a curveball at me. And yeah, I remember things exactly how they happened.
Well, and if you're truthful, you don't have to worry about a curveball.
Yeah, I don't worry about anything.
Okay. Well, you know, there's some controversy in regards to, you know, obviously your life and career. Like you've mm-hmm. had some incredible highs and some incredible lows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does that ever? Do you ever get haunted by what could have been or what might be?
Yeah, you know, I have nightmares every night. I have nightmares about prison, nightmares about Afghanistan, the war, nightmares about the whole Rafael Torre thing. And I just had another one of those nightmares about Rafael here. Oh, I don't know, a week ago, you know, and in my dream, Rafael is coming up for some sort of court meeting. He's been in prison 20 years, and him and I are sharing a room together, a little holding cell together, waiting to go in there and testify. And I think, oh my God, what if I have to fight Rafael right here in this holding cell? I know he's 60 now, but still. And this stuff haunts me. All this stuff haunts me. You know, I don't know when the last time I've had a good night's sleep was.
Yeah, that's not good. Well, here, just so everybody at home knows, in terms of like, why don't we start with your credibility in regards to like your career within the sport of mixed martial arts. The rubber guard, the rollout of the rubber guard, Eddie Bravo, you were there day one. Mm-hmm. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Like, what were the meetings like in regards to Eddie kind of coming together and thinking about like this new process in regards to jiu-jitsu? What do you recall about it?
Well, I remember we were really young. Eddie was a purple belt. I was a white belt. And Rafael would bring me from the high desert where we were living and training down to train with Eddie in Hollywood. He was on North Gardner Street there, right in downtown where everything's happening. And he had this little teeny tiny bungalow house behind the real house. So it was, you know, the address had the half after it, you know, like 1013 and a half Gardner Street, North Gardner Street. So he had back there, and he just rolled these little Velcro mats together. I mean, by today's standards, it was pretty funny. But we were back there working on this stuff from the very beginning. And then he would go back to John Jock's Academy, train there every day. And he would practice the stuff that he was, you know, working on. And when I would fight, I would practice the stuff we were working on. I was just starting my career. I started fighting when I was only a blue belt. So that's how the stuff started. And then a lot of the names came from what would help us when we're coaching each other on the mat. And also, we didn't want our opponents to know what we're doing. If you tell your opponent to do a classic Brazilian jiu-jitsu move, everyone hears it. The opponent hears it. So Eddie came up with different names, so nobody knew what we were talking about.
Okay. So at this time, was Joe Rogan also in the mix, or are you pre-Rogan?
Yeah, no. Joe Rogan was in the mix. Joe Rogan, he would come to Eddie's little mat area there. And we're talking 12 feet by 8 feet or something with a big metal pipe for the plumbing that if you hit that, the training was over for the day, you know, you get hurt. But yeah, Joe was there from the very beginning.
So you're talking Velcro mats in a pretty much a broom closet. And yeah. It's who's all in the room at that time?
But we had a guy next door, and he trained with Raw, Real American Wrestling, with Rico Chiparella.
Yeah,
his name was Scott, and he was cool. He trained next door. Everybody came to Eddie's.
Do you remember Scott's last name?
I don't remember Scott's name. But yeah, we had people coming from all over. We had Eddie Bravo was a big thing, and people were starting to pay attention. All the Machado brothers, you know, they call it RCJ Machado, Egan, Carlos, Johnny, and John Jock. Also, they all took notice of Eddie because he was tapping people out with some of these weird things. First of all, his name, he didn't give himself the name, the Twister. It wasn't called the Twister. They called it him the Tornado, the Tornado, you know, like a twister for a tornado. And I think that was from Hegan. But anyway, everybody would come by Eddie's fighters, current fighters, up and coming wannabe fighters. I remember it wasn't long until we had Dan Henderson coming down to train with Eddie, drove from Portland to go to San Diego. And the biggest thing on his itinerary was to stop and train at the Bomb Squad with Eddie.
Okay. So when you guys are coming up with the ingredients for the rubber guard, was this kind of open to a lot of people, or was it just a select few to, like, as you say, kind of keep things private until it was ready to roll out?
That's a great question. Eddie would let anybody train. Anybody. He was excited about this stuff. There's no money in it. This was back out. I laugh when I watched this tap out special about where was the money, Eddie Millis from the Shark Tank. We did this because we loved it. There was no money in this. We paid money to fight. After a 3-month training camp, I ended up paying money to go fight because there was no fight purse to speak of. So Eddie would let anybody train, anybody.
And show the system as it was developing.
Yep.
Really?
Eddie would roll with every single person in a class. He would roll with every single person in a seminar with 50 people. He would roll with everybody all the way up to the gigantic super heavyweights because he was trying to get people as excited about these things, you know, as we were. And it was a totally different time. Now, Eddie won't roll with anybody outside his weight class. You know, that's how you get injured and your career is over. But Eddie would roll with super heavyweights from, you know, Samoans and stuff, all of them. It was just a different time, and everybody was invited, and it was cheap. It was free forever, then it was cheap forever, too.
Now, he, like you had said, he came up with different names, like the meat hook. You know, it's like the triangle Uma Plata setup. Mm-hmm. The London, the New School, those are some of the names. Mission Control, obviously. Mm-hmm. We've all heard that on a UFC pay-per-view. So the brainstorming of the movements, would he ever kind of do this with you in terms of like creating the blueprint?
Yeah, he would have me try to punch him. So as he was working on like the meat hook, he would have me push him up against the cage. And before we had a cage, push him up against the mats on the wall and try to punch him. That's how we did all of our jiu-jitsu, was basically with punches involved. So all the junk got weeded out. All the stuff that wasn't real for a fight went away. You know, like all the holding on, like spider guard and all those things, those don't exist when someone's slicked up at the beach trying to punch you like Hugo Duarte and Hicks and Gracie. You
know? Right. So at the October 5th, 2002, the ADCC qualifier in Los Angeles, you obviously were there.
I think, I was at the qualifier for sure. Yeah. And then when he was in Brazil, I taught his class when he was gone.
So the qualifier, it seemed like that Eddie went into it with the full intention of going up against Hoyler Gracie in the big show.
Yeah. He said that from the very beginning. Yeah. He called that. And I think he even called, he said he was going to tap him too. He might've even said he was in a triangle, but he said, I'm going to tap Hoyler. He said that long before. People just laughed at him. He's only a brown belt. You know, Hoyler had 9 or 12 world titles, the Mundials, which is the gi title in Brazil, the big one. He had all those. Hoyler had never been tapped. I think Mario Sperry choked him out, but Mario Sperry was like 230 pounds. You know, I think that was the only loss anybody ever knew of. He was the champion of the family, not Hickson. Hickson, you know, no, Hoyler was the champion of the family.
So Mark Ashton was his first opponent at the qualifier. And, you know, what's crazy is the Twister was, you know, the Tornado or the Twister was such a new move that it was kind of surprising that the referee called it as like a spinal lock. It was like before it really got rolled out and the referee spotted it. So Mark Ashton, he wins by rear naked choke. Sean Creasa, he wins by points. He's out of Borland Combat, Team Canada. Alan Tao, obviously black belt under Henzo, beats him with points. And he qualifies after that. Were you surprised that he was able to go through the competition and that in the qualifier the way he did?
No, because we had some guys out there, little secret warriors that we knew that Eddie had gone up against, like Romy Arum he had rolled with, and more so than Romy Arum, Javier Vasquez.
Legend.
It was as good as anybody in the world. I swear that guy was a ninja. And Eddie had gone against him. So Eddie had gone against these guys. I think he even went against BJ Penn. But we had guys out there. Charlie Kohler from San Diego was incredible. If you ever heard of, he had the Camphor Club. So Eddie had gone against some really, really incredible guys. So it was almost like the East Coast, West Coast rap wars, you know, Big E and Tupac. Yeah. So we knew Eddie was going to work. We knew he'd beat Alan Tejo for sure. He has nothing to worry about. The only guy out there to worry about was BJ Penn and maybe one or two other guys that, you know, in Eddie's weight class.
Eddie wore a long sleeve shirt instead of a rash guard. Do you even remember why? Was it like a sponsor thing or was there a purpose?
We want our overhook. When we end up in guard, closed guard, butterfly guard, we want that overhook. The whole system is how do we get a hand trapped to the mat? And for years and years and years, people would just give us the hand trapped to the mat. So we would instantly have a hold of them, shoot out our legs, shoot up triangles, shoot out omoplatas, bump out, put a butterfly hook in and sweep them with a Jean-Jacques stick shift sweep. So that overhook is essential. So that having that traction from that cotton t-shirt, you're smoked. If you get caught in an overhook and you're anywhere near Eddie's weight class, you're toast. You're going to go over or get tapped. There's no... Yeah.
That's incredible. Okay. Did you go to Sao Paulo for the May 17, 2002?
I taught class. Eddie was teaching. Eddie had his school going at the bomb squad. And I taught Eddie's classes while Eddie was there. Jamie Walsh went with him and Joe did.
Okay. So now Jamie Walsh, I believe he is the brown belt. He was a brown belt at the time under Gene Jacques. He was also was he from Europe?
Yeah. Yeah. He's from England.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So Jamie and Joe went with him. Like preparation for him leaving. Like how confident was like Hoyler Gracie at this time was kind of like the Michael Jordan of jiu-jitsu for the lower weight classes. Like he was as bulletproof in terms of the sport as there that had existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did his confidence come from?
You know, Eddie talked about, he said that Hoyler wouldn't know what was going on, which is true. Hoyler didn't have any idea. He's like, I'm going to come at him and lock the shoulder and I'm going to climb my guard up. I'm going to come at him with, the attacks, you know, the special stuff he'd been working on for a few years. And he said, and he's not going to know the defense. You know, it's kind of like when Hoyce Gracie went to the UFC, nobody understood anything about jiu-jitsu. So therefore he tapped Ken Shamrock and these guys. So this style of jiu-jitsu is so radically different than gi jiu-jitsu that it was almost cheating being able to get a close guard with an overhook on Hoyler. Of course, he's going to get caught up in a triangle. He's going to be in a whole mess of triangles, omoplatas, and there's always arm bars off of triangles that aren't quite working. We knew he was going to be in a whole bunch of shit.
See, you say that, but then, you know, your previous statement was that Eddie had allowed anybody to train with him he wanted. Mm-hmm. Were those upper echelon guys just refusing to acknowledge or participate in the type of system that Eddie was employing at the time?
Yeah, a lot of guys didn't believe in it. A lot of guys said, oh, it's kind of a fad, or, oh, it, you know, if it didn't work on BJ Penn in BJ's garage in Hilo, it doesn't work well. You know, Eddie just kept refining it, and sharpening it. And Eddie, I don't know if he still uses this term, but he used a term called grease style. So basically, if you're training in Los Angeles in August, in about 30 seconds, you're covered in so much sweat that that's considered a grease style. So before the gi pants, we would wear those little bad boy shorts or tap out. I remember tap out loaning fighter shorts and getting them back after the fight. So we would have these little tight Valley Tudo shorts on, but we were grease style. So yeah, Eddie, a lot of these guys didn't believe in it. You know, you could yank out of arm bars if you're really good at jiu-jitsu and Eddie's just working on the London, or he's just developing the meat hook and the guy yanks out of a couple of them, they wrote it off as nothing. Now, I mean, I don't know how many schools Eddie has and how many, I know Eddie's got hundreds and hundreds of I think he's at hundreds of schools now.
I listened to his podcast and he said the other day it was like 150.
Yeah. And they're real schools. They're not like in a little.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're real.
Yeah.
They're academies. So.
Yeah. Yeah. How would you describe your relationship with Eddie at that time?
Eddie was everything for me. I didn't know when you saved someone's email that they could see the name you gave them, but I would email Eddie. I didn't have a phone, so I'd email Eddie, and down there I had him down there. I think it's Matt God, you know, like the God of the mats. I worshipped Eddie. Everything. Yeah. Eddie fed me. I remember we were always broke, and Eddie was broke. He was a DJ at a strip club. You know, he didn't have any money, and a 10-13 and a half North Gardner. That was expensive rent. That was in the heart of Hollywood. So, but he would feed me. He would pick me up where I was living on someone's couch and take me clear across to Tarzana to train with Jean-Jacques. He would pick me up and take me down to, there'd be different grappling competitions in Orange County. Eddie would take me. Yeah. And he had an old beat up Ford, was a Ford Explorer, like the old style. Yeah.
Well, okay. But if you're originally from Oregon, how do you two connect?
Rafael Torre. Rafael, being from Oregon, had moved down there to Southern California right off of the Marine base and started working on the Marine base. That's how I reunited with Rafael after quite a few years. I'm walking across the base at 29 Palms and I hear my first name, and you normally don't hear Gerald. Hey, Gerald. You hear Sergeant Streetman. So I look and it's Rafael Torre, and he's on base. And he said, hey, I'm a lifeguard at the base pool. And I said, hey, are you training? And of course he said he's training. I said, well, they've got a mat room here. Let's start training. So Rafael and I start training at the mat room on base. And then I had enough money saved up from being deployed overseas to where I bought us a gym. I got us the mats and got a gym open up out in town, and the rest, we started training every day and had students and fighting. And that's how I got Rafael started. I paid the money to get the first gym going. And
okay.
This is
before any fights whatsoever.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. This is 1998, the end of 98 or beginning of 1999.
Okay, good. Now we're getting the interview started. Okay, so what was your introduction to jiu-jitsu?
I had competed as a wrestler in Rafael Torre's tournament called the Oregon State Submission Championships, and it was just right down the road from where I'm at right now. It's only 10 minutes from here, and he had rented out this community center called the IWA Hall, and he brought in wrestling mats. And he invited everybody. Lance Gibson came from AMC Pancration, Canada. Yeah,
of course.
Lance Gibson came. Matt Hume sent students. We had people from all over coming to the Oregon State Submission Championship. I took second place. I got a picture and my little purple singlet with skinny legs and wrestling shoes, and Rafael handing me my ribbon and me shaking his hand.
Yeah. Okay, so Rafael, obviously, I mean, he's been a subject on a Joe Rogan Experience. You know, Eddie Bravo has talked about him quite a bit as well. He was a fake black belt. I think we can agree on that at this point. But did he have any submission grappling experience at all? Or did he just come in as, I'm doing tournaments, I know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, he was horrible. He was a blue belt, about a blue belt level. And not like today's blue belts. Today's blue belts would wipe him out. He was old school blue belt level, and he was very selective who he would roll with. You know, the whole time he was doing this charade, he was always very careful who he rolled with. He messed up and rolled Chris Brennan one time and got learned real quick the difference, you know. So, but yeah, no, he's horrible on the mat.
And how do you know Rafael?
My uncle, my mom's brother, married a woman. Her name's Randy. And when they had a child together, and when they got a divorce, Rafael married Randy. So I've known Randy since I was just a little baby. And and her son, and darn it, he just passed away from cancer here a few months ago. His name is Brandon. Yeah, horrible, horrible life. Life just deals you these blows. But so Randy married Rafael afterwards. So, and that's okay. And Rafael was a big deal in this town. Rafael had a karate school in this town of Coos Bay, Oregon. He was a big deal.
Yeah. Okay. Did he have an actual karate background?
I knew a friend who trained with him for a long, long time and said every time a movie would come out, Rafael was all of a sudden a master of that martial art. So it started out karate from the karate. I'm not kidding you. Started out karate from the Karate Kid. He was a great grandmaster, learned in Hawaii. All of a sudden, Steven Seagal has these great moves, hard to kill and all that. Raphael's teaching Aikido. I swear, every time Hollywood would put out a movie, Raphael all of a sudden then knew that martial art. So it was only natural that when Hoist Gracie won the UFC, well, of course, Hoist's great uncle's cousin's brother was Raphael's secret trainer. You know, that's how it went.
Okay.
You know what I mean? All of a sudden he had to segue into jiu-jitsu. So it was his father, Julian, who actually was his stepdad here, trained in Brazil with the Gracies in the 50s as a merchant marine. That was the story. It was all nonsense. Yeah, it was nonsense.
Okay. So in terms of salesperson, was Raphael on a high end or the low end in regards to being able to sell bullshit?
Oh, he sold bullshit. Yeah, he would take a splinter of truth he knew how the human brain worked. So he would take a little splinter of truth and get that in there. So you get a little bit of legitimacy and then he'd spin off of it. Yeah, I think it was some big world leader said, you know, don't tell little lies, tell a gigantic lie. They'll believe those gigantic lies. I think that was Hitler. Hitler said that. If you Google that, don't waste your time telling little lies. Those are hard to sell. Tell the big one.
So when Raphael kind of came to prominence, like, I'm not going to say he's a household name because MMA wasn't a household sport at the time, but he was at front and center for a long time and had entries into social circles that he didn't belong in.
Yeah, definitely.
How would you describe his maneuvering?
You know, he would have gone even a lot further if his ego kind of got in the way. He got fame. He made some money off this with the Prince of Abu Dhabi. I mean, he made a lot of money writing for Abu Dhabi. He got tickets to go. He got to go to Pride and announce all these Pride shows. He got to be in, I think, Rico Rodriguez's corner in Pride. He got, you know, so but his ego got in there. He started to really believe his own hype. But he could sell a story. I remember him hanging out with Josh Barnett and Mark Kerr. I got to go train with Mark Kerr, the Pride champion. He's on the Olympic wrestling team. Mark Kerr, the Smashing Machine. I got to train with Mark Kerr. I just walk right into the Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu Club. There's Boss Rutan and Mark Kerr and Rico Rodriguez and a couple other guys that nobody knew about. And I got to just put my shorts on and start training because of Raphael. Said, "Oh, here's my nephew. You know, let my nephew train." Just with his word.
But Raphael did he actually train there or was it just he'd show up and socialize?
Yeah, he'd show up, socialize. He'd put his shorts on and get some pictures. He'd like to do the photo ops, but he would never do real training. Those guys they would know right away. I mean, obviously Rico Rodriguez won Abu Dhabi and they would know right away that he was fraudulent. So he would say, "I'm just going to do some moves. Let's just flow through some drills." He always had an excuse, but you know, that only goes for so long. He did that for years until Eddie finally exposed him. Eddie finally said, "This dude's not a black belt."
So where do you think the breaking point between Eddie and Raphael, like when do you think Eddie finally had enough?
When he realized he was being lied to. When Eddie was 100% certain, he really rolled with Raphael and obviously beat him very easily, like he'd never trained a day in his life. And Eddie is no bullshit. You can't lie to Eddie. You can't steal from Eddie or do Eddie dirty. You're gone. You're toast. So as soon as it was obvious that Raphael had been lying to Eddie, Eddie's like, "Fuck that guy." And he told Joe.
What brought it to that point?
They rolled. They finally rolled all out.
Okay.
And he'd been suspecting. He'd been suspecting for a long time. Eddie's really smart. He'd been suspecting for a long time. And then when they finally rolled, he came to me and it's a hard thing to tell, you know, because I was his nephew. I was his Raphael's best guy. You know, at that time, I might have been his only guy, I think. But he said, "No, he's not a black belt and he's fucking lying to us." You know, and then the Machados, I went down. I got sideways with Raphael because I was a young Marine. It was 1998 or 99. And I went down to train in Torrance with the Machado brothers. And Raphael was so mad because he knew, because I think I just got my blue belt. He knew that that could expose him. That could expose him as being fraudulent because I'm going to talk to Hegan. And there's a brother most people don't know of, Johnny Machado. And I'm going to talk to them. And Johnny taught a lot of the classes. And they're not going to know who Raphael is. And they're not going to believe this merchant marine story. And they didn't. I've got pictures. Actually, I was a white belt. I have pictures with my white belt on with Johnny on one arm and Hegan on the other. You know, it was pretty exciting to meet them. And when they said, you know, who do you train with? And I told them, they looked at each other and started speaking in Portuguese, but they're real professionals. They're not going to do anything to hurt my feelings or, you know, so they said, oh yeah, that's great, my friend. That's great. No, they were saying in Portuguese bullshit. Yeah.
Wow. Now, was Rafael close with Eddie as well, or were they just kind of?
Oh, no, they were close.
Really?
No, they were friends. No, Eddie and Rafael were friends, man. Total friends. Would you put
Rogan in that category as well with Rafael?
No, Rogan, he's bulletproof. He doesn't open himself up to get you don't get in Joe's life. He's got like, it's hard to describe, but you can't just bullshit your way into Joe's life. Joe was living on a friend's couch in like Newark, New Jersey, teaching Taekwondo lessons and was completely broke. And he's self-made. He built himself up through all of his comedy. He got a 15-minute slot at a comedy store because somebody didn't show up. He said, Joe, see if you can fill this in. So Joe does this comedy and just tears the place up. They thought it was the greatest thing they ever heard. They said, you can come back anytime. Please, we'd be honored. That's how Joe got started. Then he got, then he was big in the comedy circuit. Then he got news radio and that went syndicated. Then he got Fear Factor. So he built himself up to be worth like $30 million or $20 million. And then he was bulletproof. You know, he was friends with Rafael, but there was always a barrier. Like he's not going to loan Rafael $1,000. And Rafael's not going to go stay at Joe's house and spend the night at his house. That's not happening.
What about your relationship with Joe?
Oh, Joe gave me a lot of money. Yeah, Joe gave me a lot of money. Paid for all my stuff. Yeah, Joe was 100% the best to me ever. Joe drove down to Beverly Hills and put me up in a Beverly Hills hotel, like an apartment type hotel for a month to train for a world title fight I was fighting in England. Yeah, Joe paid for my training, like $225 or $250 a month with Jean-Jacques for 2 years. He just paid for it. Joe bought me food. Joe bought me training equipment. Joe is the best. Joe got other sponsors, you know, to help me out. The guy from Eddie got me Nature's Purist, Crazy Larry from Nature's Purist. Joe got me a really famous producer in the adult film industry to sponsor me. Yeah, Joe was awesome to me. I never deserved all that wonderful things Joe did for me, or Eddie. Eddie did a lot of great stuff for me too for years. But
yeah. Rafael Torre, how would you describe what took place? Like, the finish line of where Rafael is sitting at, how he got there, the entirety of the experience.
How would I describe that?
Yes.
It played out like a Greek tragedy. It's like watching a surveillance video of a horrific train crash and you already know the ending, but you can't say anything because it's on the video and no one can hear you scream. He had the world by the tail. He had all these opportunities and he had made some money. But, you know, he, like I said, his ego and his pride rubbed a few people the wrong way, got people asking questions. And then once it was found out, Eddie exposed him and that did him in. Then he was no longer in the circles. You know, people believed Eddie and of course they believed Joe. And then other people spoke up. They said, you know, I didn't think that guy was legitimate either. You know, Javier Vasquez and different guys and Terry Treblecock, he owned King of the Cage. He's like, yeah. None of that stuff really made sense with me, but I gave him the benefit of the doubt. So then all of a sudden, Rafael's ruined. So now he has no income. He can't have a school.
Did he lose everything at that point, or was he still employed by certain individuals or companies?
There was a turning point with his journalism career where he said, it was after September 11th, 2001. He said, I can't wait for the sands to run red with Muslim blood. He had said something. Yeah, I think he's probably high. So he said that silly thing on that. And then the prince just, he's gone. He's out of anything related with Abu Dhabi. Probably took all his articles down. You know, it was a pretty rotten thing to say. And so then his career was done. Eddie exposed him. He was done. So now he's living off of this girlfriend of his, a secret girlfriend who's married to a friend of ours, a guy that treated us really, really good. His name is Brian Richards. So Raphael, he's now a mooch, complete mooch. He's now working behind the sale, behind the store doing sales of supplements at like a strip mall selling, you know, creatine and stuff, in like a Max Muscle type place. Yeah, he went from being somebody to working minimum wage.
So he didn't ever think of leaving like LA, going back to Oregon.
No, he liked the club life. So he was involved with this guy named Shiloh MacGyver, Shiloh something. Okay. And they were doing this club called Club Rubber that moved around, and they did a lot of, the club was all about ecstasy and dancing and the crazy nightlife. And this a hugely famous nightclub. So Raphael fell in love with that lifestyle. So, but he couldn't afford that lifestyle, but he fell in love with the nightlife and the clubs. And I didn't know, I found out when they did a drug test on him when he was incarcerated, when he got taken in, and he had methamphetamine in his system and other stuff. And I didn't know, I had no idea he was doing meth, but he had sores on his arms, always had sores on his arms. And he said, "Oh yeah, it's a mosquito bites or mosquitoes got me." Man, we're in Palm Springs, you know, I've never seen the mosquitoes down there, but yeah, he was doing meth, and he had a whole secret part of his life that people didn't know about.
Wow. So it just kind of came crashing down from everywhere.
Yeah, and I'd say Eddie, when Eddie came out with that, that was it. And he said that thing about the Muslim blood, and he was done. He was all of a sudden a nobody and a minimum wage worker at the mall.
Man, that's rough.
Yeah.
That's rough. That's actually really rough.
He admitted to me that he made the whole thing up. People, if there's anybody out there that still says, you know, I think he still had skills, I think he did have jujitsu, he admitted to me he made the whole thing up at the very end.
You cornered him with Rico Rodriguez in his fake fight.
Mm-hmm. And Mark Kerr.
And Mark Kerr. That's right. It was you, Mark Kerr, and Rico Rodriguez.
Yeah.
What were the conversations like before he walks out as well as after?
We thought he was legitimate. So Mark and Rico and I were pumped about this. And as soon as it happened, as soon as the knee bar happened, I looked at Mark, because I'm just a youngster. And so I look at Mark and I look at Rico, and they're looking at each other, and they thought that it looked awful fishy. And I didn't say anything. I didn't want to be in, you know, if Raphael thought that maybe his cornerman thought that was a work, I didn't want my name on that, but I didn't think it was legit. It didn't make any sense. The knee bar was absolutely wrong. Yeah, but Mark Kerr and Rico Rodriguez looked at each other, specifically Rico, because Rico knew submission, and Rico's like,
oh,
no.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, no. Rico's like, no. Rico's embarrassed, you know. During the, they wanted to interview Raphael afterwards, and he's got the big smile on his face. He's, you know, these young kids are too good. I'm going to let them take the reins. Well, Mark Kerr and Rico and I, you couldn't get us to get in there and stand next to him. He's like, come on, boys, get in here. Of course, he wants to get more on the bandwagon with Mark Kerr. Boy, everyone just got out. It was bad. Yeah, we got away from him.
What about the conversations afterward? Like in the locker room.
Well, what's crazy is they disappeared. Rico and Mark, they were very wealthy, you know, and they had all their fancy cars and all their money. And so they disappeared. So then it was just me and Raphael. And I think I drove there with Raphael. So I saw Terry Treblecock gave him, there was a thing about the money. I think Raphael, that's what it was. Terry Treblecock was going to give him $2,500 for the fight. Flat fee, $2,500. And when Terry paid him, and Raphael said, "Hey Gerald, I'm not telling the truth to Randy. I'm telling her he gave me $1,500, you know, so I can put $1,000 away for something else." Well, that $1,000 he gave to Big Joe for the work. So I thought it was awful funny that he was going to lie to his wife about the $1,000 difference. And Raphael had no money, and he said, "Yeah, don't say anything. Don't say how much you saw Terry pay me, because I'm going to hide $1,000," and then. Later, I talked to Big Joe because I saw him in town, and he had another one of our former students, Kenny Tenorio, and they said, "You know, that was a work, right?" And I still didn't want to believe it, but they said, "You know, that was a work, right? He gave Joe $1,000 to take that dive." And I thought, oh my God. Of course, I told Eddie, you know, and Joe Rogan. But yeah, he gave Big Joe $1,000, the secret $1,000 that he said. Yeah.
Was there any fight camp?
You know... Yeah.
Do you mean like,
yeah, it was not like a fight camp. It was like it was a figment of his imagination. We would go in there and he'd put on his matching tap out top and tap out bottom with his mesh sores. and he'd be doing spinning kicks, and we didn't know, you know, I'd fought a couple low level fights. I didn't know what a fight camp was like. So a bunch of us students would wrestle him one after the next, and we're all white belts. So he'd beat up a white belt student, and someone would get on him, and I would get him. This is no shit. I got him in a chokehold first time I ever tapped him. And he goes, "Oh, hold on. My contact. Well, I have him in a freaking triangle choke. He's going out. He doesn't want to tap to me. I'm a one stripe blue belt. You know, he's the grand master getting ready to fight the big main event of King of the Cage. And I'm tapping him out. He said his contact was out.
Your first fight, April 21st, 2001, Bushido 2, Aaron Herring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At that point, did you understand that mixed martial arts was going to be a pretty pivotal point in your life?
I didn't. It was something I wanted, but I had no idea. I had no idea. And I had Frank Shamrock in my corner for that fight. That's crazy to look back on. I had, of course, Eddie Bravo and Rafael Torre. But my hero of the fighting world at that time, it was Frank Shamrock. Everybody, you know, all of us young kids wanted to see ourselves as being physically fit like that and being a wild man like that and a UFC champion. And here I've got Frank in my corner. It was
Did you work out with Frank? Part of
no, I practiced some stuff on the set of a movie I did with Frank. Frank was a big movie superstar alongside Pam Anderson and Tom Sizemore and Gary Busey in a movie that went straight to DVD. It was called No Rules. The UFC sued it because of trademark infringement on the Octagon, the eight-sided fighting arena, so the movie couldn't come out. But it had Gary Busey and Tom Sizemore and me, had me in there, Dan Anderson, Frank Shamrock. So I trained with him a little bit on the set of that movie, but not competitive training. Yeah.
Okay. You also fought for Kaja's Cage Combat, July 9th, mm-hmm. 2001 against Mike Meadow. Okay.
Meadow. He was a Fabiano Iha student and trained with Tito Ortiz and Fabiano Iha.
That's correct. And you obviously won by armbar, but Kaja, his Cage Combat,
mm-hmm.
he purported to have been doing the octagon style fighting pre-UFC.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think his credibility is at?
I think he's got credibility. He came out with a tap out logo. Remember the tap out? The shape of the tap out? That was his whole thing. And I think it said something different. Maybe it said Cage Combat, you know, but that whole thing was his thing. Tap out uses that and made hundreds of millions of dollars. Probably, he was doing the eight-sided fighting arena back at the very beginning.
Was it okay? So I haven't seen any posters back then or any video, and mm-hmm. that doesn't mean it didn't exist, mm-hmm. Because it was a different time, a different era. Was it mostly pro wrestling or actual fights?
Fights, but they were under a circus tent, like Barnum and Bailey shit. Because the LAPD were in helicopters trying to catch us fighting. So open hand cage fighting, any type of MMA was illegal. And back then, you know, a lot of these events, you could kick the face on the ground. So these things were barbaric. They were in circus tents, so the LAPD couldn't see us with the helicopters. And they would arrest everybody at an event. They'd arrest the fighters even if they could catch you. So that's why a lot of his stuff is probably, you know, his early stuff, probably there is no posters of it.
Yeah, he like 91, 92, he's claiming that he was doing eight-sided cage fighting. In fact, you had just mentioned you were in a movie. The UFC put a kibosh to it because they used an eight-side mm-hmm. octagon. The mm-hmm. UFC, after that point, were looking for organizations countrywide and sending mm-hmm. them cease and desist.
Mm-hmm.
Kaja never got one.
Wow. That's interesting. I tend to believe Kaja. I tend to believe him.
It's an interesting footnote, man, that a lot of people don't pay attention to.
Hmm. Yeah, he had a guy fighting for him named Maverick, and Maverick had his eyebrows tattooed on him. You ever hear that underground cage fighter from LA, Maverick?
Yeah.
That'd be a fun one to look up. I wonder what that guy's doing these days.
Right. Hopefully he's on the side of the grass. Gladiator Challenge. You had fought Aaron Anderson August 19th, 2001. Mm-hmm. That was kind of like the Wild West of the California days. Was this one of those movie set type things where they had to submit the results prior, or was it like legit results, legit fights?
They had to submit results prior, on some of those. I don't know if this one particularly they did that, but I do remember them having to do that. But yeah, I fought a few times for the Gladiator Challenge. I fought up in the Rumble in the Rockies. I fought the Calusa Casino in Sacramento a couple times.
And you fought Noah Schnabel, obviously. Mm-hmm. You were cornered by Boss Rutten in that fight.
Yeah, it was cool. God, that was wild. That was wild. Boss was so high that he just volunteered to be my corner man and walked out with me. Yeah, I had no idea. He was so high. Yeah, and the security there's Indian gaming casinos. Those are run by the natives. And, you know, they'll have the big tattoos going down their chin. Have you ever seen those big tattoos on the natives?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The wider
oh,
and thicker, yeah, yeah. the more seniority they have. So this big, you know, like the boss man of the commission's got all these tattoos. And he's like, you know, only the designated corner man boss just blasted right by him. Just went right down. Yeah. The funny thing about that fight is we got a tape. We used to get a tape of your fight. So Boss Rutten and I go down to the breakfast thing in the morning to get the continental breakfast the next morning. And I have my tape and he's got that crazy accent. He goes, put it in, let's watch it. So we're in there at breakfast and we put it in the VCR that they used to roll around for meetings and stuff. We put it in and we made everybody who's eating breakfast watch the fight. And he's screaming, ah, this is where you did that. Yeah. It was wild. Here I'm with Boss Rutten in this breakfast joint at a scuzzy casino watching the tape of my fight from last night. It was wild.
You also fought Crazy Horse Charles Bennett.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How was he pre-fight? Was he like the Charles Bennett that we know now, or was he kind of somebody different?
Oh no, he went out. He was high, smoking weed basically at the weigh-ins, and he's drinking. And then he goes out to the strip club. He goes out to the strip club after weigh-ins. We're fighting the next day. You know, I'm back in my room doing yoga and trying to, you know, meditate. He's going out to the strip club with a blunt in his mouth, and stayed up all night long, and that got back to me. They said, oh yeah, he's been partying all night long. And I said, oh, he has no idea. I'm going to toast him tomorrow. Crazy Horse is built different than a lot of people, because I tore that dude's ACL and meniscus and he still beat me. Yeah, it was wild.
You heard him grunting in it. Yeah. Oh. You could tell you tore that thing like big time.
Yeah. But I saw him at the airport the next day. He's in a wheelchair being pushed around by the Delta Airlines lady in the wheelchair holding his trophy. Yeah, he's crazy. Yeah. He's one of the old. Yeah. I think he knocked out Vanderlei Silva in a back locker room brawl in Pride.
Yeah. Yes, he did. In fact, I was at, I think it was BKFC 9 in Tampa, Florida. And Feldman at the time brought it either 6 or 9. I think it was 9. Feldman brought in Fabricio Werdum, Wanderlei Silva, like a who's who of the era. And Crazy Horse was there. Crazy Horse is in the audience and they're in the ring. And from the ring, like this is years later, there was still a kind of back and forth like, oh, we know you're here. You're going to catch another one. You're catching another one. And like Crazy Horse, I'm not going to say he was on his best behavior, but he was well aware of where they were at in the building as compared to himself.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So right around this time also, Rafael Torre kind of comes into play in regards to what took place with the murder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How does that begin?
It began on a drive from his house. I was living with him in Yucca Valley. And it started from a drive where I told him, I don't want to train. I'm going to train with Chris Brennan. And I already knew he was a fraud. I hadn't confronted him with it. But I said, Chris Brennan has got this incredible no-gi jiu-jitsu program. And he was like one of the first. He really was. And had really good jiu-jitsu, good students. He had a real fight team, a professional team in uniforms. And he had an octagon. He had everything. I said, I want to go back down to Irvine, actually Lake Forest, and train in Orange County with Chris Brennan. So Rafael's driving me, and I didn't have a vehicle. I didn't have a car until I was 24 years old, or I never drove till I was 24 years old. Yeah. So Rafael's driving me back down there. And that's when he said, hey, you know, he was interested in trying to find someone to help him get rid of his opposition. You know, that's when he solicited me for that murder. It was on that drive down there.
And is this before he got exposed or after?
Before.
Okay. This is before. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. But was he real loose with facts at this point? Were you guys kind of rolling your eyes at a certain point? Did you believe it? Or were you?
Did I believe that about the murder, that he was trying to get the murder done?
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was, he was very, very straightforward with it. I understood immediately that the wife was trying to get him to get me to kill her husband. I knew, I could tell. what he said is, Brian Richards was a really good guy, just so that you know, and I know, and everybody knows, Brian Richards is a really nice person. And I'm 45 almost years old. Now I look back, he was so young. He must've been 32 years old. I can't imagine, you know, someone trying to end my life at 32 years old. It's really, I'm just now starting to understand the gravity of that whole situation. But Raphael said, Angel, the wife, Angel said her husband, Brian's abusive and that he's dangerous. And I've heard that before. That's how a woman starts to get her secret boyfriend to get involved with her relationship, is he's dangerous, he's abusive. And she is to the point she's afraid of him. And she would at this point like to get rid of him. And then Raphael's driving, he said, she at this point is to the point she would like him just to be done, get rid of him, like to see him go away forever. And then he looks at me and I'm in the passenger side and I understand right away what he's saying. And she said, and she knows you're a sniper in the Marine Corps, and she's wondering if you would be interested, if you'd have any ideas, if you'd be interested. And I looked at him and he said, you know, and there'd be some money involved, like $10,000. Well, shit, you're asking me to kill this guy for her on her behalf. And the only reason she's not in prison right now is she never asked me. So I couldn't with good conscience say, yeah, she asked me, or she would be right there with Raphael. So Raphael said that. And I said, Raphael, I said, whoa, 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 you're going to get wrapped up in this thing. First of all, he's probably not abusive. I said, this is probably just an angry wife and she's looking to get half the house since they had a nice house and whatnot. She's making this shit up, and you're going to get caught up in it and end up in jail. And I didn't know the difference back then between jail and prison. You're going to end up in jail and she's going to get this $1 million life insurance policy, because he said that she had a $1 million policy on him. And sure enough, that's exactly how it played out. It's exactly 1 month later, a month and a half later, the guy's dead.
Hey, did you ever hear why the police never charged Angel Richardson?
Yeah, they don't. And this came straight from the district attorney, Aunt Williams. They don't want to take her to grand jury and get a not a true bill, they call it. So that have the grand jury say, no, there's not enough here to even proceed. And they don't want to, if they surpass that, they don't want to get to trial and have a couple holdouts, because they don't have, or to my knowledge, the direct evidence of her asking me that, or anything direct evidence on her. I mean, it's obvious when you listen to the wiretap tapes that she, you know, when I call her and say, hey, you know, your dead husband's pistol, I have it at my house, Raphael gave it to me, you would think that she would have called the police immediately, like, hey, I just got a phone call from Raphael's nephew. He's got Brian's pistol. That was missing, right? She said, call Raphael, just call Raphael. It's obvious that she set this whole thing up. But there's a big difference in what's obvious to us and what's beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, in court.
There was a rumor that Jason Reese was involved in the murder as well. I guess he took over the karate school from Raphael. Is really, yeah, true? In your opinion, obviously we're talking opinion here.
Zero chance. I have an idea. I know if they found a DNA, they did find DNA at the crime scene that wasn't Raphael's. And I do believe Raphael had help, because Raphael isn't in good enough shape to run a mile and a half or whatever it is from the Albertsons parking lot where he parked the truck and they found the body back to the gym, the facility where he killed him. I don't think Raphael could run that far. And I know who I think helped Raphael. I don't have any direct evidence of that, but Raphael had another student of ours, and I'll just say that, who had helped Raphael with some crimes, some insurance fraud and some other crimes. So there was one student Raphael could count on to help him commit felonies and do all that. And I'm sure that that's who the DNA is. I'm sure that that's who helped at least give him the ride back from the Albertsons to his truck.
Out of curiosity, why do you think Raphael never rolled on anybody? Like, he never rolled on Angel, never rolled on this guy.
Dude, think about it. It's a great question. Brilliant question. Then he has to admit he did it. He was going to hold out to the very end. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. And hoping, it's a gamble, that he would be found not guilty, or they would get the verdict would be split, and then the DA might not file it again or whatever. So, but the moment he would admit, or the moment he would claim, because he already said, I have nothing to do with it. I was at home with Randy, my wife, now to come back. So he was all in. He put all his chips in the center. And, but after, before he went to prison, while he's in the county jail, he offered to work with Kent Williams after he was found guilty. He said, okay, Angel had a part to do this. I'll help you with Angel. And Kent Williams said, I can't touch you now. You've lied on the stand. You're a known liar. Nothing you say is going to carry any weight with a jury. So they weren't going to risk that with Angel.
You know, once you do that and you start, okay, now I'm willing to work with you. Man, that ship has sailed, especially when you get like 30 years.
Life without parole, LWOP, LWOP. LWOP. That means no chance ever of parole. If you pull up a lot of these known criminals, Mexican mafia hitmen in the California correctional facility, he'll say they're getting out, the earliest year is 2089 and stuff. With him, it just says LWOP, life without parole.
Well, around this time also was when you were working with the police in regards to, but let me ask about the murder weapon first. Mm-hmm. You mentioned about a gun. This was the victim's pistol. Mm-hmm. But a gun was never used, at least in the actual murder.
Yeah, that was just a part of his, Raphael's story about why he had to physically get into a confrontation, why he had to even put a rear naked choke on Brian, is because Brian came at him with this Glock Model 21-45 pistol. So he's knocked it from his hands, put him in a chokehold. It was an accident. He broke the hyoid bone over the larynx, and which is common for
hanging,
that strangulation type killing. Yeah. So he had to have an excuse for that. So he said, yeah, he came at me with a pistol. The pistol was in Brian's truck. Brian kept that truck in his pistol. But Raphael gave me that pistol. He asked if I would be his alibi and say he was with me that night. No, I'm not going to say you're with me that night. And I happened to be home for Christmas. So my airline tickets, the DA and the DA's investigators pulled him up. My airline tickets proved that I had flown in to Eugene, Oregon, from LA. So he couldn't say he was with me. So he said, I told him that. I said, I'm on record with a credit card and everything as being home for Christmas. So he said, I think he killed him like December 21st of 2001. So anyway, he said, well, then hang on to this pistol, and if they do arrest me, come forward with my story that he came at me with this pistol. So I had that pistol for almost a year, wrapped up in a T-shirt of Raphael's and a bunch of plastic bags.
Okay. So why did it take you a year to come forward?
I wanted Raphael to get caught. I knew someone had helped him with this to get the ride back from the Albertsons to his truck. So I didn't want to be the one. I didn't know how the legal system worked. I didn't know that if by me holding onto this pistol and being prepared to tell this bullshit story, if that's going to get me arrested for being an accomplice, or I didn't know. I was terrified and I'm scared of Raphael. I mean, Raphael is ready to take violence to the highest level and kill a person with his bare hands. I know it. He just told me he did it. And he asked me previously if I wanted to do it. So I know now that I was wrong. I thought I talked Raphael out of it. I thought for sure Raphael didn't have it in him to do that to somebody. I had never even considered it. So I was scared, terrified. And then when Raphael showed up at my doorstep in Hollywood. I'm living in Hollywood on the corner of Fountain and Sweetser. He shows up with a bag full of stuff, supplements and weight stuff he's stolen from the supplement store he's working at, and a stack of cash, because he's going to try to pay me back for all the money that I've loaned him to get his gym going. And he just showed up down there. So he said, I've got good news. They've paid $50,000 on the $1 million already, but they're getting ready, because it's been like a year. They're getting ready to pay the rest, the $950,000 or whatever dollars of the $1 million life insurance policy. So they knew that it was a murder. Obviously they figured Angel and Raphael did it, but they couldn't prove it as far as the insurance company. I think it was AIG insurance. So he said, we're going to get paid. And I knew right then, I'm not going to let you get paid. I'm not going to let you get away with this. So I called the very next day. I called the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department and got a hold of homicide. And I got a hold of Detective Brad Toms, who was one of the detectives on the case. And told him, we need to get together. I've got enough information on this to wrap this up for you.
Okay. So when you called them, I mean, we obviously heard it on the tapes. they're usually in an investigation, everything gets locked down and quiet, mm-hmm. or it's supposed to be. But the MMA and jiu-jitsu community was so small, mm-hmm. but also so tight-knit. Were there any leaks in regards to the investigation while it was going down?
Immediately. I was shunned. And that was my life. Mixed martial arts was my life. But I had Terry Treblecock say bad things to me in Mexico, at an event in Mexico.
What was said by Terry?
Well, we're at this event in Mexico, and we're on Revolution Boulevard in Tijuana, which is the main drag in Mexico. And there's all the fighters are there. I'm fighting. Vernon Tiger White was there. There were a bunch of famous guys there. So Terry says, "Hey, Gerald." And so I walked over to him. He kind of called me over there. And Eddie Bravo was there. I don't know if Eddie was right there, but Eddie was at the event with me. He said, "Hey, Gerald, come here." So I go over there amongst a bunch of my peers. I mean, we're talking Vernon White, you know, a bunch of good fighters. And he goes, "So I heard you're ratting out your uncle." See, he just said that in front of all these guys. "I've heard you're ratting out your uncle." And see, Terry Treblecock had previously told me if Rafael needs a place to hide out, because they were investigating him, they were starting to do surveillance on him, and they were starting to wiretap Rafael's phones, and they were following him. Terry Treblecock said, "If he needs a place to hide out, I've got a place in Mexico. He can stay as long as he wants." So Terry Treblecock is like homeboys with Rafael. So he called me over there and did that in front of all those guys. And I'll just say, you know, if anybody murdered any one of those guys, those famous fighters, their family would pray that somebody would come forward and be like, "Listen, this is a dirty, filthy killing of a person who was not prepared to fight, much less fight to the death for money." So I don't care what anybody says about me telling on Rafael. He murdered this man for money, and the guy was completely defenseless.
You know, in terms of crossing lines, you know, murder, child molestation, rape, like, I mean, it's pretty much your top three right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well,
no coming back from that.
No. UFC 44, Josh Thompson, September 26, 2003. It's been talked about a lot, including recently. This was also, if my timeline is correct, around the time when you were working with the DA in regards to wrapping up Rafael. Am I off on that?
No, that's right.
Where was your mindset going into that fight?
Man, I was working with the police during the buildup, the training part of the fight. And then while in Vegas, I think they were getting ready to arrest him. So in Vegas, I would get phone calls from Rafael, and I don't even think I had a phone at that time. So he'd call Eddie Bravo or call Chris Brennan or whoever was around me and say, hand him the phone. So I had that going on, and I knew that the arrest was coming. I knew that it was imminent. And, there was a lot. And I was only 24 years old, and I wasn't a mature, war-hardened 24-year-old. You know, I was pretty soft-spoken, really not a very super tough guy. This was a lot on me. You know, it weighed heavily on me, that decision.
Different kind of weight. Yeah, it's a different kind of weight. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had that going on, and the UFC was such a juggernaut. You know, it was a lot of pressure. I remember crying in my hotel room, just sitting there crying, and Chris Brennan, it was like a big brother to me, just sitting there holding on to me, saying, "You're all right, man. It's just a fight. You're all right." The pressure of the fight, he's holding on to me, hugging me like a kid. And I'm going, I'm never fighting again. If I get through this fight, I'm never fighting again.
Chris, in our interview with him, was talking about a time where you guys were not in the jury box, but behind, you know, waiting to testify. It was like him, Rogan,
Eddie Bravo.
Eddie Bravo and yourself. Yeah. How would you describe that time in the courtroom?
That was crazy, because Chris Brennan, I love him like a brother. I would do anything for Chris Brennan. But Chris Brennan and I had a beef, and people would call the gym all the time. Mothers would call the gym. You know, "I've tried to cancel my son's contract." And I lived at Chris's gym. Me and Rampage Jackson and Duke Garrity and a couple other nitwits.
Yeah, Brian Garrity.
So I would answer those phone, Next Generation Fighting Academy. And I'm some young, excited kid to be a part of this. And sometimes it was the mothers who wanted to cancel. So I would make a big, I'm a Marine, so I'd make a note of the time they called, their social security number, all their info. Chris didn't want to hear that. He had 175 students. He was making so much money, he didn't even have fucking room in his house to store it all. And, you know, he's on this roller coaster. He doesn't want to hear this shit. So I would rip on him like, Chris, you never called this lady back. She's called again. And he's like, listen, and Chris told me this. He said, you're sitting there on the front steps of my gym with bad news. He goes, every time I come in there, it's something bad news. And he threatened to kick me upside the head or something. So I threatened him back, which I could never beat Chris Brennan up. So he threatened to kick me upside the head or something. And so I left. I got out of there. He threatened me. I got out of there. So I permanently, I was training with Eddie Bravo part-time, Chris Brennan part-time. So I permanently moved up there. Eddie got me moved in up in Hollywood, and I permanently trained with him. It's just one of those things, you know, it's just like if you have a pack of pit bulls, they're eventually going to start biting at each other. But then at night, they're all curled up at night. Yeah. Anyway. So Chris is cool, man. Chris is cool. But yeah, so we're there. And I told Joe Rogan that. And Chris hurt my neck in training because Chris was getting ready to fight in Pride 33 or something. Maybe the UFC 33. And he hurt my neck. And Chris was always bigger, stronger, better fighter than me. I was still a kid. And so he hurt my neck, and I felt like it was intentional. Like he really, really hurt my neck because we were shark tanking him, and I might've tapped him out, but it wasn't a legitimate tap out because he had just went seven rounds.
Yeah.
So I finally tapped him out or something. And he just cranked my neck, and I told Joe, and Joe wanted to kill him. Joe was so mad at him for hurting my neck. So yeah. So I never went back to train. So we're in this room together. So it's Joe who's now shut Chris off. Joe's like, fuck you. Joe's right. Joe's tough, dude. Joe is really tough. Joe tapped me out even in the height of my career. Joe could tap me out. Yeah, Joe's very good. Yeah. So it was awkward being in there. And we're joking and laughing because Chris and I are friends. Man, we're blood brothers. But you could sense that it was tense between Joe and Chris and then Eddie and I. And then we understand the gravity of what we're about to testify to. So we're all just waiting there. It's like, yeah, it was wild. It was a wild time. And Joe has lawyers, and Joe's really smart. Joe's smarter than any of us. Joe's got lawyers, and Joe can't mar his name with this stuff. Joe can't be doing $100 million deal with Spotify and be involved in any of this shit.
Why was Joe in that room?
They tapped him talking to me on my phone. They had wiretaps of Joe and I. They had wiretapped Joe and I. Talking about the murder.
Did he end up testifying, or was he just in the back room with a possibility of being called?
He testified, but he said, you know, I remember Gerald saying something about that, but I really don't remember what. And then they're like, well, he told you about the murder. We have it on tape. Yeah, but I really didn't even consider it was real. He downplayed it. And basically his testimony wasn't worth anything.
So that's what he said. Did any of you guys think it was real at the time, or were you just thinking
it was bullshit? No, I was at Joe's house. Joe lived at a place called Bell Canyon. It's a place where Vince Neil from Motley Crue lives, Alyssa Milano. It's a pretty exclusive place. And I was at Joe's house in Bell Canyon. He had two houses there. I was at the first one before he sold it and got a bigger one. And he said, and I told him exactly what happened, him and Eddie Bravo. I told them both exactly what happened because they said, listen, we think he's fraudulent and we think he did this murder. And I said, he absolutely did this murder. And I told him everything that had happened about that. Raphael asking me to kill the guy. Then the guy ends up getting murdered. I told him everything. And I remember it started with Eddie asking me, do you think Raphael would do that? Do you think he had anything to do with that? And at that point I'd been holding this in. I just told him everything.
Wow. Yeah. Josh Thompson. In regards to that fight, how would you describe the ending?
The ending.
The knockout.
How I got beat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going for a heel hook, and I was completely, I mean, in over my head. Josh Thompson's awesome fighter. And going for a heel hook, and the punch you don't see coming, I didn't even have my mouth, I wasn't even biting down on my mouthpiece. I was going for this heel hook and trying to get it caught to where I can hopefully do some damage, and just got a little flash of light, and my jaw was completely loose. And I'm not a Chris Lieben, Mayhem Miller, Phil Baroni type guy with my chin anyway. I'm a pussy. So a good punch will rattle me. Yeah, no, a good punch will rattle me. Yeah, no, I don't. Yeah, there's probably two people in the house I'm living at now that could beat me up: my mother-in-law and my girlfriend. So, yeah, no,
it was all culminating at the exact same time.
Yeah, Rafael calls me right before I leave my hotel suite at the Mandalay Bay to go down and fight. Rafael's calling me on the phone. As soon as I'm done, Rafael calls me in tears. I heard you got hurt. Are you okay? I love you. He's sensing. He's already sensing. They've already come to his work. They went to his work. They purposely, detectives are so smart. You're a detective. They went to his work when they knew he wasn't there, and they told his coworkers, yeah, we're here, homicide. We want to talk to Rafael. Well, they know Rafael, where they're doing surveillance on Rafael. They want those guys talking. They want Rafael to get his phone call then from his coworker. So if they know anything, they're wiretapping Rafael. So maybe his coworker will call and say, dude, they're here, man. We said this day might come. So he felt the noose tightening.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, dude, it's crazy shit, man. That's crazy shit. And that's just one of the many crazy shit things that happened in your life.
One of the many.
Well, why do you think you were there at the beginning of the Rubber Guard? You were there with Joe Rogan. Obviously, you guys were on very real good paper before he became Joe Rogan.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like big events are attracted to you. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I. It's just now sinking in. Sometimes I can't believe it. Sometimes I can't believe that Pam Anderson's brother stopped the set of a movie and had them all sing me happy birthday and gave me Kid Rock's tennis shoes that Richie had just left on Pam Anderson's deck, and they just split up the week prior. So now I've got Kid Rock's tennis shoes for my birthday present. I've got Tom Sizemore and everybody else at this movie set stopping what they're doing for me. It was crazy. And those things happen to me all the time. I had more wonderful things happen to me in my life. Yeah, I've been blessed and cursed.
Yeah, and cursed, right. Chris Riley, owner and coach and trainer at Team Bomb Squad. Mm-hmm. How would you describe your relationship with him as well as his aptitude as a trainer?
Wonderful man. One of the best people. One of the best people I've ever known. 100% solid. I've got some stories with Chris Riley. wonderful person, did a lot for me. Great trainer, really, really fun person to be around. It's a shame him and his wife split up. He was married to Lauren Hodges, who's a famous actress, and that fell apart. I was living on their couch while they were going through some of their marital stuff. But yeah, I love Chris Riley. He's a great guy.
You were also involved in a traffic incident involving David Crowfoot.
Mm-hmm. Crowfoot, yeah.
Crowfoot. So I've heard the... Go ahead.
Nope, I didn't say anything.
No. You have been, you released the 911 audio. Your lawyer also was willing to give interviews in regards to it. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the incident, obviously, in hindsight?
It played out exactly how it was supposed to play out, and it played out exactly how it would probably play out if it happened tonight. And my wife and I were coming back from the theater, and some guy starts ramming us with his truck. I don't have firearms anymore, but I've played this thing over in my head. It's been 10 years. January of... Right now is the 10-year anniversary. I think it might have been the 21st or the 29th of January. So we're coming up on 10 years. And he did everything possible to get shot by a Marine sniper. I mean, I backed away from him. I backed away over 85 feet. I begged him to leave me alone. And I had a loaded AR-15. I have no qualms with shooting somebody under that circumstance, or under a circumstance where I'm afraid. And I shot him right in the forehead.
I will tell you, there's police officers that are in prison right now for people pulling out cell phones, digging in their pockets and pulling out cell phones in a way to where people thought, the people on the other end thought that they were reaching for a gun.
Yeah.
And your background, like Chael Sonnen did a video on it.
That hurt me when Chael did that. That hurt me when Chael did that. That didn't make sense. I've always loved that guy. I've always thought so highly of him, considered him a friend, been to his family's house before, Matt Lindland and I. I don't understand why he would put all that vitriol and all that effort into, trying to hurt me. it's crazy. He's just said some crazy things, just crazy things that made no sense. Like, I knew Gerald would never be, this guy would never fight in England. Well, I fought in England 5 times, every time for the world title. I fought Shaolin Ribeiro. I fought Gene Silva twice. Like, he just said weird stuff, stuff that was factually had no basis whatsoever. And then attacked me for that incident in Portland on one of the security guys there from Portland, for me having my pistol on me, and they threw me out of that event up there. And I have apologized to that guy profusely. I had been drinking all day long, got into a physical confrontation with one of the security guards up there, apologized to that guy profusely. And here we are, 15 years later, making a special segment on the Chael Sonnen Show about it.
What's strange is, like, Chael will be the first person to say, always punch up, never punch down. And will criticize other fighters in regards to, like, their trash talk, in regards to, well, you're kind of going down on that trash talk. You've got to punch up. He really went out of his way to punch down in that video.
Weird. I just, because it sells. I mean, he can't have anything against me. I've always been a fanboy. I've always been, in his presence. Because I went up there to train with Team Quest with Matt Lindland and Randy Couture when I was getting ready for a fight. I've always been just like the biggest fan, wished him the best. Always liked Chael Sonnen. It was weird. It was weird. It hurt me. I just got out of prison and I saw that Chael Sonnen tells stories on Gerald's treatment. And it's embarrassing to say this, but I thought, oh, cool. You'd be telling some fun stories of our training and some of the things we did. Cause we went out, not just in training, but we went out to the Hood River Brewery in Portland. We went out and had some fun stuff and did some fun stuff. And I spent time with him away from just the fighting stuff. And that was just weird that he made that whole thing about. Yeah. It was bizarre. Hurt my feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. In 2004, you trained with Dean Lister.
Oh, yeah. God dang. That guy's good, man.
So Dean Lister, the year prior, won the absolute. But at UFC 60 against Alessio Sicara, he's using the rubber guard. Mm-hmm. And Eddie Bravo was like, hey, he used the rubber guard. He's hyping it up. My system. But he came under attack. Eddie came under attack. Internet jerk-offs. Saying, yeah, but you didn't train him, Eddie. You didn't work out with him a single time. Was Dean Lister's like entry level into the rubber guard with that of yourself?
Dean Lister came up from San Diego. He was training with a Hicks and Gracie black belt, an old man. I can't remember his name. He came to Hollywood specifically to train with Eddie Bravo, specifically on the rubber guard. I was there. Love Dean Lister. One of the best jiu-jitsu guys that's ever lived. But he came up there to train with Eddie Bravo. Eddie Bravo didn't go down there to spend his time and gas money. And Dean Lister came up to Hollywood, which is a long way from San Diego, to get that training. I was there. And
Dean Lister is good. Dean Lister's, ADCC Hall of Fame.
I still use moves on Dean Lister on my girlfriend. We're fighting over blankets because she rolls up in the blankets. So I use a hip escape from Dean Lister. And you can see my hand. I get that in her armpit and get her away and get my blankets back.
part of the Chael Sonnen video was him referencing you being handsy with an underage student. I've looked into this quite a bit. Into this case, I've seen court documentation and records. Mm-hmm. Why don't you take us through it before I put my two cents in?
Okay.
Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I've got nothing to hide. Everything with me is on a court record or a deposition or a court paper. I got accused of the criminal act of grabbing a teenage girl's butt. And I got accused of grabbing her butt while she gave me a hug in between classes, leaving from one class. She couldn't take the second class. Her auntie was just pulled up to pick her up from the gym.
This is in a classroom setting. Is she alone?
It's on my mats.
Is there other people there?
Yeah. I'm talking with another mother of the students, Mia Fredrickson, her maiden name is Mia Burgess, Mia Fredrickson at the time, talking to this lady in between the classes. One class over, a girl comes up, says, I've got to leave, my aunt's here, gives me a hug, turns and leaves. And she told her cousin that I think his hands were lower than they should have been, as in me, on this hug. My hands were lower than they should have been. She never said I grabbed her butt. She never said I, you know, I mean, I'm sitting here talking to Mia Fredrickson, and that's in the court papers. They got Mia Fredrickson to give a statement and to come in and testify in court. Mia said, I was right there. If I had seen him do that, I would have punched him in the face. I'm a mother. It's just insanely bizarre.
Okay. Okay. I agree with that. I agree with it being insanely bizarre. I've read the court papers, and it's unfortunate what Google says and what actually took place. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing. So at this time also, I believe they're working on a book and a movie script in regards to your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your attorneys that were behind this, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I had a couple different movie scripts. I had the Bobby Razick. Is that how you pronounce his name? Life in the Cage.
Yes. Great guy. Great, great. Phenomenal work by him.
I had him coming to me with an idea on a movie script. I had my attorneys working on one and the book deal. The book was out. The book was actually selling really great. I think it came out in October of 17. And I think that it sold. It was the same month O.J. Simpson's book came out, If I Did It or something. I think we outsold him in that month that it came out. We sold a lot of copies on that book. Still selling copies of that book. That was going on. And that book was really hard on the judge and the DA. And I personally don't have any problems. I don't have any problems with anybody. The judge is just doing the best job they could during that shooting trial. And the DA is doing the best job that they probably can with the information they have. And it's over. I did my time. I got a 58-month sentence. I ended up serving 41 and a half months of that sentence with good time and an early release program. And that's over. I don't owe them anything, and I'm not mad at them. If I see that DA out fishing the river, I'm going to say hello to him. I have no problems. But this book comes out, and the book, my attorneys, I wrote that book and sold the rights to my attorneys. They rewrote it, got some ghostwriters, put $50,000 for editors, and made it a book that's maybe a little bit more coherent than my ramblings and prison letters. And they were able to market that thing. Well, they attack that judge. They attack that DA's office relentlessly. And that's fine. But I feel that the DA and the judge came back for me, and they wanted seconds on me. They feel I got away with it, or they feel that I'm laughing at them because I only did 41 months in the shooting. That's not me. That's my attorneys, and that's the way they marketed that book. I feel that okay. When I was used to grab this girl's butt, that was because they're coming. Just like
okay. So how does this roll out? When do you understand that what is being said about you is getting serious?
I realize the mother had texted me, because this girl was this incredible jiu-jitsu phenomenon. Like, she was the best student at our gym, and male or female, she was going to be like Ronda Rousey. Her jiu-jitsu was so incredible. She had this special gift, and she was really tough too. She wasn't afraid. She beat men, and she's a teenage girl. She was beating some of the full grown men in there. They'd come in, you know, having wrestlers. Yeah, she was incredible. If I wasn't careful rolling with her, she could tap me. If I wasn't careful, I had to really, you know, anyway, I saw that she was going to go a long ways in the sport. And I see dollar signs. I see me being in her corner in the UFC one day. She was going to be a big deal. So, I want to sponsor her. You know, she wasn't going to pay for training anymore. You know, she was an asset to the gym. And I told her mom and dad, I said, let me sponsor her, and let's provide her with all the training equipment she needs. You know, rash guards, boxing gloves, everything she needs. And you need those spandex, those tight spandex rash guards shirts, you know, for when you train, so that it keeps you contained. Women. They took that, I believe they took that as weird, like, you know, a sports bra and an Under Armour. I even said an Under Armour rash guard, you know, because she's wearing her her teeny bopper high school bra she would wear at school, she'd wear in training. That's not, you know, that's not good for jiu-jitsu and wrestling. So we need to get her some Under Armour rash guards. And I think that kicked off a thing in their head, like, oh, that's weird. They never said anything to me. The mother, I could sense the mother was creeped out at me wanting to sponsor her and putting so much effort into her. And it started from there. And they came to more classes. I saw them on Saturday, the next Saturday. And then they said, well, we'll come to the gym if you have one of your other instructors teaching. So I had other instructors teaching. And so I would teach the different class. And so this went on for a month. This went on for a month. And then all of a sudden, they come in and arrest me. Well, while I'm going, they come in and arrest me. They said, you grabbed her butt. Well, I watched these interview and she said, his hands went lower than they should have been. I don't think it was intentional. This is on the police interview. I don't think it was intentional. He's never done that before. Well, they did three more interviews off of camera, body cameras turned off. Then they come back in and they say, yep, she's convinced that it was intentional and that you did it on purpose. So they arrest me. So she's changed her story, whether they've coached her along or whether she was trying to hide the fact that she thought I grabbed her butt before trying to protect me. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt that she was just being pushed by her parents and the police. And it was about the shooting. This butt grabbing thing was about the shooting. So went to prison. I get it overturned in the Oregon Court of Appeals, throws it out. It's been dismissed. It's not on my record.
Well, let's talk about that process. How long were you sitting in prison for?
I did 18 months incarcerated, and I did over 3 years on an ankle monitor, home confinement, had to be in by 10 o'clock at night, couldn't leave before 6 in the morning. So five years.
Did you ever violate?
No, never violated, never.
Okay. So the video that they had, like in court, while this was all playing out, did you have a paid attorney or did you have a court appointed attorney?
Oh no, I had a paid attorney. I had Brian Boonder. I had a really good paid attorney. He does a lot of death penalty cases, lots of murder cases, and he felt so strongly about this case. He came in and defended me on it.
Okay. So there's video evidence of her saying no, 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 but there's no video evidence of her saying yes, yes, yes. Did she take the stand as an underage child?
She did.
Okay. And what was her testimony?
Yeah, her testimony was what the police said. The whole basis was his hands were lower than they should have been. And she didn't say he grabbed my butt, which is, you know, and if you grab someone's butt, it has to be for like sexual gratification for either yourself or for your alleged victim. And she didn't say that. They said, okay, so you came in, you gave him a hug and his hands were lower than they should have been. She said, yes. Were his hands on your butt when he hugged you? Yes. Did he squeeze you in when he hugged you? Well, that's the definition of a hug. You know, you squeeze someone when you hug them. So they sat there and they walked her right along with exactly what to say to maybe meet the criteria of I grabbed her butt. And that was the basis of the whole thing. And the jury wasn't buying it. The jury went back and deliberated on it. And it was offensive to some of them. They got kicked off the jury selection. They said, is it even illegal to grab someone's butt? Is that like a possible prison sentence? They kicked them right off the jury immediately. So they kept getting the pool down smaller and smaller and smaller. Back while the jury's deliberating, they've heard my testimony. Like, I don't think I grabbed her butt. I don't think my hands were lower than they should have been. But we're talking, this has been now 2 years prior on a hug. I honestly don't know where my hands were 2 years ago on a hug. I didn't mean to. I don't think that they were, but, you know.
And you're still on probation for the shooting.
Still on probation for the shooting.
So that, when people talk about the time, that's where the time comes in.
Yeah, that aggravated it to a felony. Yeah, if you're already on parole, that makes it a Class C felony. And if you're a teacher and you grab someone's butt, that doubles it and makes it a felony too. So it's now doubled and doubled. So, but anyway, it got overturned and thrown out. It's gone.
It got overturned. They also approached her again.
Oh, yeah. They went to try to get her to say it again. She won't talk to them. She won't cooperate. They set up an appointment for her to meet up with them and she won't go. So,
yeah, several times.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel bad. She had the world by the tail. I don't think she doesn't do jujitsu anymore. Unfortunately, she'd be a force to be reckoned with. And I think that she was manipulated. I think that she was done dirty in this situation. It kind of took jujitsu from her.
The state not charging you again. Did you expect that?
You know, I had people telling me that's how it was going to play out. I had people telling me exactly how it was going to play out. And they waited till 45 minutes before the next trial. They said they're going to take me to trial again on it and try to give me a plea bargain. And I said, no, we'll go to trial. It was Friday at like 4:15 in the afternoon. They closed at 5. They came across with an email, said we're dropping it. So they dropped it. They dismissed it. I showed up to court and a courtroom full of people for all kinds of various crimes. I was the first one on the docket. It was really strange. I said, okay, first case today, State versus Strebent, case from January of 2018. Da, 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 and this was just a couple years ago. And the state's making a motion to dismiss. And the state said like one sentence. Yeah. And yeah, that's what we want. And they turned to me and I, you know, it was weird. It was like, it was pre-planned to get me in and get me out of there. When they were doing it the first time, they had all the press there. They had newspaper people trying to agitate me on the sidewalk, walking into the courtroom, run up on me with a camera, trying to see if they could get a violent response from me or something, trying to get something sensational for the Register Guard. And now that it's being dismissed and it's been overturned, it's been thrown out by the Supreme Court. Now there's nobody there. It was like, nope, have a good day. So I walked out of there. I got my ankle monitor taken off and it was crazy. It was surreal. And they could come again. They could come again. Yeah. I suppose they could come again tomorrow. They might see this and think, let's get his ass.
How hard was that going through that?
Oh, it's devastating. I get to prison and I can fight. I would prefer not to fight. You know, I'm an old guy now, but I get to prison and I've got to fight. You know, I got to fight so I can go out on the yard and I can walk the yard with my head held high. I'm not letting anybody take my food. I'm not going to let someone tell me what cell I can be in. So I had to go in there and go back to the old ways. You know, I had to go back there and I had to basically, I had to pretend that I wasn't a soft-spoken pussy. I had to go in there and put on this aura of being a tough guy, like a psychopath. So I could scare these guys a little bit and get through my 18 months. And I did. I got through my 18 months. First minute of the first day, I got the biggest, strongest gang member. They call him Big Tex, telling me I can't be in the cell with him. And he's huge. He looks like Kimbo Slice. He's huge. Yeah. I throw my bags down and I turn on him and I said, I'll just fight you for the cell. And that's how it goes in prison. If you don't do that, Mike, you're going to be walked on for the rest of the time. You know, it's when it's go time. If anybody says anything, you better not say anything unless you're ready to do 6 months in the hole, 180 day hole shot, you know, for a big violent act.
I tell you, like, the thing is, like, the longer the people are locked up, the less commissary, the less people that come and visit, the less people that'll take phone calls. So it's like the people that have been there the longest literally have the least to lose.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. A lot of the guys I was in there with are dead. I watched the news and they're up in Portland, and Portland's a shithole now. And one of them just got killed. One of them just got shot and killed in a home invasion robbery. And some guys have killed themselves. Some guys have overdosed on fentanyl. That's a big problem here in the Pacific Northwest now. So, you know, in Afghanistan, a lot of the guys I was with there are gone. A lot of the Marines I was with that went on to go to Iraq, they're gone. It's wild as you get older, looking back at everybody, you know, people that aren't around anymore.
Have you, has Rafael Torrey reached out to you since he got locked up?
Never has. No, never has. I would be open to writing him, or, you know, if he wrote me a letter, I'd write him back.
Yeah, if you look how that conviction went down, I'm surprised he wasn't able to get it back into court.
He got done dirty. The legal system, I'm telling you, the legal system, we have these rights. And if you go through your constitutional rights, then every state has its constitutional rights, which gives you even a little bit more. They cheated. They cheated on Rafael's trial and the preparation for trial. They committed what they call Brady violations, where they withheld evidence that could have helped his defense, would have, without a doubt, 100% chance, helped his defense. They withheld that. And they would tell you I'm lying. They would say I made it all up. But I have nothing to gain. If this guy ever got out, he'd probably want to kill me. But I'm telling you, he didn't get a fair trial.
Yeah, I don't think he did either. Like, I'm not as deep into my research with what happened there as I was with, you know, the case that we had just talked about. Mm-hmm. But by them not touching Angel Richardson, man, there's red flags all over that.
And one day maybe they will, but they said, we get one shot at it. So we get her in front of a jury and we don't get her, then she can go out and write a book like O.J. Simpson, you know?
Yeah, that's wild. That's wild.
Yeah. They got her in civil court for the judgment. They garnish her wages. So.
Well, you've trained with some of the greatest people in the entire world at like their peak.
Mm-hmm.
And you're now sitting in a position where, I mean, are you teaching jiu-jitsu or mixed martial arts anywhere?
I'll never teach jiu-jitsu again. It's going to die with me. Everything I've ever done is I'll never touch it again.
That's fucked up.
It's okay.
That's fucked up. Right now.
It's okay. I like to go fishing now. I'm gonna go steelhead fishing later.
You've done
a steelheader in.
Yeah, you've done about 5 years total in prison. Am I correct? 5 or 6?
Yeah. All in all for the shooting and then the butt grab charge.
Yeah. How are you dealing with all of that? Like the PTSD in regards to it, along with the PTSD of your military career.
You know, I have nightmares basically every night. Had them last night. Had nightmares last night. Prison nightmares last night. Sometimes it's the war. Sometimes in Afghanistan with Blackwater was pretty wild. Sometimes it's the shooting prison type nightmare. Sometimes, like last night was my second series or set in prison. I was having the nightmares last night, you know, fighting again, having to fight to make sure you can go where you want. You got your food and everything. So I have nightmares every night. I look forward to the day when the nightmares stop for sure.
Have you ever looked into the alternative treatments like psilocybin or DMT in regards to trauma?
Yeah, I'm starting to. I'm going to do, I think that there's research coming out. There's going to be empirical data. There's going to be, there's a lot of developments with the psilocybin stuff. And I'm definitely open to that. I tried one time the medicine that the VA gave me because I've got full VA healthcare and none of that. I'm not going to do any of those selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and all that. I don't do any of that. I don't take anything.
Dean Lister claimed it saved his life.
Really? The psilocybin.
Yeah.
I've tried some of the little gummies, like little teeny tiny microdose, and they're kind of take the edge off. Some guys, I remember Joe back in the day and Eddie, they were taking DMNT and ayahuasca and stuff. They had this guy, Zachariah Sinchin, was this guy that had all these documentaries and he was like the most experienced guy with hallucinogenics, and they used to watch his documentaries. So then they would practice some of the stuff that he preached, but I never did that. So
yeah, I hope you're open to it.
Definitely.
Good. You also cornered Robert Kilpatrick, Ken Shamrock's brother.
Yeah. I like him. Fight. Yeah. He's such a nice guy. I heard he's in prison for like 20 years or something.
Yeah. Another guy.
Is he? He's in the white dope. He's in that white dope. And if you combine drugs with a gun, which is what I think they might have got him with a gun, then it quadruples the sentence. But he's such a nice guy. Old Bobby Kilpatrick, Robbie or Bobby, you can call him either. But yeah, he's the biological brother. I think he had the same dad as Ken Shamrock and a different mom, or the same mom and a different dad. But he looks just like Ken Shamrock.
How was he as like a training partner? And where did you guys roll?
Up in Portland. He's great. He's a good wrestler. He's tough. But he was fighting, God, there are a couple of those brothers. There's redheaded, gnarly fighters with big broken noses out of Team Quest. And I can't remember the names, but they're the Healy brothers, Pat Healy and Ryan Healy.
So Pat Healy is a commissioner in, I think, Nebraska right now.
Is he?
Yeah.
That's awesome. They're great. They're really good guys, and they're tough. They're tough.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He beat the tar out of him. He did a flying knee and broke his ribs so hard he's bleeding out his nose and ears or something. He smashed Robbie up pretty bad. The Healy's are tough.
Did you know Bobby Hoffman?
Yeah. I wrote Bobby Hoffman in prison. I was the only guy that was writing him and getting letters back when he was in prison. Yeah. It was wild.
Did you know him pre-prison?
Yeah, I knew him from the fights. Everybody knew him from the fights. And he was a local legend. And so, I mean, he was the bad seed. He was no joke. But yeah, he was a great fighter. He fought in rings and fought all over the place. And he started fighting for King of the Cage. And that's how I met him, through Raphael and all the group at King of the Cage. And then he got into that wife beating thing on their honeymoon, like it's some Section 8 motel or something. He got too much drugs in him and beat her up. But yeah, he felt horrible about that. He just, you know, drugs. Yeah. Got high. I wrote him in prison. He was a great guy. Really nice guy to me.
Yeah, to you. Right.
He was a shot caller. He was a shot caller for the whites in there. And that's a big deal. And California prisons are way different.
Did you see him in prison? Did you see him in prison?
No. Oh, no. I would never survive a California prison. I was in Oregon. Yeah.
Okay. Is he still in jail?
No. He's out now. He's an old man now, but he's out. He's done. Somebody said he's kind of cuckoo now. I wonder if the drugs and stuff, if he didn't go too deep into the drugs to where he can't come back. Someone said that he's kind of zoned out now. He's
off the grid. I've tried to find him for years. He's off the grid.
Yeah. Darn it.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't been able to track him down ever. Mm-hmm. At the X1 World event in Hawaii, you were there. I think you were with Brian Garrity, mm-hmm. Raphael Torrey. Mm-hmm. Jeff Monson was on the undercard. Did you interact mm-hmm. with him at all?
No, never interact with Jeff Monson at all.
What was it like working out with Rampage Jackson?
Loved it, man. He was a good guy. He was always nice to me, and living with him, being a roommate, you know, I spent a lot of personal time with him. We had a gym membership. I was telling somebody the other day, we had a gym membership because we didn't have showers at the gym we lived at. So we would train and we would go down to the gym and shower. And I'm standing next to Rampage Jackson showering. And I'm like, I'm never showering next to this guy ever again. This is humiliating. So we would alternate when he'd go down the shower and I would.
Guy's funny. Carl Parisian. Did you work out with him?
Oh, yeah. Carl Parisian. Yeah. Him and Manny Gambieran. Both of them. Yeah.
So really, you were in really... the same room with Ronda Rousey too then?
Yeah. She was doing... she was young judo. Then. She was doing judo. They were all doing judo, but Carl Parisian and Manny, and there were a couple other guys. I went there for Harut, this gangster Armenian fighter, Harut Terizan. And he's like, lives in Las Vegas. He's like a gangster. But he was like King Kong there. And then he wasn't there. So it was Carl Parisian and Manny Gambieran and a couple other guys, Roman. There was a guy named Roman there. There were some really good, tough guys there at that academy. It was called the Hayastan, and it was way down Sunset Boulevard towards East Hollywood. And now it's in North Hollywood, where the Armenians have like Little Armenia. But when I was training there, it was way down Sunset.
Right. Eddie Bravo, when was the last time you guys two talked?
About a week before I got arrested. I called him, and there was a deal about people having to pay to use the 10th Planet name. And Eddie had told one of my business partners, when I got out of prison, I didn't have anything. You know, I didn't have a vehicle. I had to take the bus. I built it all back up, had a vehicle, had a bunch of cash in my pocket, had a couple business partners that had already leased the building. And, you know, there we're all in this together in this 10th Planet Eugene gym together. And Eddie had emailed one of them, or one of them had emailed Eddie, and they said, and Eddie said, yeah, you're going to have to sign up for the monthly deal or the yearly deal to use the name. So they came to me in a panic and they said, man, Eddie's going to charge the gym to use the name. And it just devastated me. It devastated me. So I called Eddie and he said, everyone's got to pay. And I said, Eddie, we did this back. I love you. We did this back where there was no money. I shed blood for you. I fought these fights for you. And it makes me emotional to think about it now. I said, I don't need, I'm strong enough to stand on my own, and I don't even care if my gym makes or doesn't make it. I'm not doing it. I'll be Ronin Jiu-Jitsu. I'll be the masterless samurai. I'll just do something different. I said, it pains me. If you want my money, I'll pay you all the money you want, and I'm not using your name. I won't use your name. And he started, you know, he was emotional for him, and he said, you're never paying. You're never paying. You don't pay. You can use it. You're never paying. And like a week later, I was arrested. So I haven't spoke to him since then. But he said, I don't want to fight with you, Gerald. I love you. And yeah, we don't, I don't care about money. To this very day, I don't put a value on money. You know.
Would you want to see him again?
Oh yeah. I love Eddie. Eddie did everything for me. Eddie did everything for me. I'm so happy to see him doing well. Yeah. big part of my life. Maybe the single most important person in my life.
Wow. He never wrote you in prison or anything like that? Yeah. I guess it's a hard charge. I mean, it's a hard charge, dude.
Yeah, it's a tough charge, and it's not his shit to carry. He's got enough heavy rocks in his bag. He doesn't need my extra load on his back, just like with Joe. Joe was always so good to me, loved me, took good care of me, paid for all my stuff, and made sure that I had everything I ever needed to succeed in the sport. But I can't put my name, you know, shooting these different accusations. I can't put that on Joe or anybody, you know, for that matter. So I wish them the best. And yeah, I totally understand. Totally understand.
It's a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's okay because I'm free. You know, I it's off my record. I have a good life. You know, I wake up every day excited. I'm in a good mood when I go to bed. I'm in a good mood when I wake up. This is a gift. As soon as we're done here, my girlfriend and I are going to take down the Christmas tree. You know, we're going to enjoy the rest of our Sunday. My life is blessed. My life is blessed.
Wow. Bob Sapp, did you roll with him?
No, nobody rolls with Bob Sapp. He's 350 pounds. He was so big. He's trying to, one of the boxing coaches, like, you got to bounce. You're flat footed. Bob was flat footed. If you're 350, you're flat footed. You got to get up off the ball on the balls of your feet. So he starts bouncing and broke the rafter in the boxing ring immediately. So the ring had a big dip in it. Yeah. Bob
Sapp. Where did you two work out together?
The Bomb Squad in Hollywood, Santa Monica Boulevard. That's where I got Eddie his first job teaching. I got him that job at the Bomb Squad with Todd Bird, the guy that owned it, the wealthy old Jewish trust fund kid. Bless his heart, he's passed away now. He had an addiction he couldn't conquer, and finally got him. But he was a really wonderful guy, and he believed in Eddie, needed a jiu-jitsu coach. He asked me if I would be the jiu-jitsu coach there, and I said, you don't want me, you want Eddie Bravo. And he said, well, yeah, how would I get in contact with him? I go, he lives right there at North Gardner. This is two blocks away. Santa Monica, he was two blocks. You could just walk to Eddie's house in 5 minutes. So I got Eddie that job, and then the rest is history.
Any interactions with Bob, or was he just somebody in the gym?
No, great guy. Yeah, we went out to eat at P.F. Chang's. I out-ate him. We went down there. I was cutting weight for a fight, and Bob called me Jared. No matter how many times I told him my name was Gerald, he said, my boy Jared. He even after a fight in Pride or K1, he's thanking everybody, and he goes, and I want to thank my boy Jared. So that's me. Funny. That credit, that's I'm Jared. Funny. So yeah, he's a great guy. He had a lot of good insight. He was talking with Mike Tyson, and Mike Tyson was talking to him. He loves big cats. Like Mike Tyson used to love big exotic cats like leopards and cheetahs and stuff. So Bob got into that, and he said, it's amazing that Mike told him, it's amazing when you get money, how people come, your family, you'll find out right away, you know, like Bob Sapp had money, and all of a sudden his little nephews want to be around him, and, oh, I need a car. And he said, it's money. Money is the root of all evil, is a love for money. Look what it did to Tyson, and look what it does to anybody if you're not careful. Joe Rogan. I heard somebody ask Joe Rogan, like one of his dear friends asked him for him to endorse something here a while back. And Joe's like, don't you ever come asking something like that. You're my friend. Don't ever put me in a position like that again. It was like a serious thing. Yeah. I mean, that Spotify deal, you know, Neil Young got kicked off Spotify because it was either Neil Young or Joe. And they said, bye, Neil.
Yeah. Yeah. Luigi Fioravante.
Yeah. We were in the Marines together.
You guys knew each other from the Marines.
Yeah. He trained with Rafael.
Did he really?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We were in the same room. My gym, my mats. I bought them. Yeah. We trained with Rafael together. 29 Palms, California. He's a great guy. Luigi Fioravante is a great guy.
Obaki.
Oh, Tim Catalfo. I love Tim Catalfo. Yeah, love Tim Catalfo. He was always, I was like a pet. I was a little kid amongst these guys. They always treated me really well. I remember Tim Catalfo grabbing my cauliflower ear and gently squeezing my cauliflower ear, teasing me. Tim Catalfo, he fought MMA back before MMA was even MMA. He fought.
It was NHB, yeah.
Yeah, and it was underground. They were in places like Iowa, you know. They were in it wasn't sanctioned. It wasn't on TV. And he's an old pro wrestler. He wrestled pro wrestling in Japan. He was big in Japan.
Yeah, big time. Gerald, if there's something that you wanted people to take away from yourself, your life, what would it be?
Gosh, that's a big question. I guess don't let, we only have so many days on this earth, and every one of us has a date, you know, regardless of what you believe in. Don't take any of them for granted. We're not guaranteed tomorrow. So be your best self, live your best life, be good to people. All the little things that get us pride and envy and lust and greed and these things just destroy you. Just they rob you of this gift we have. When I'm walking out to my car, I step over, a bug nowadays. I go out of my way not to crush some bug. He's living his best life. I'm living my best life. So just do your best to be a good person and be thankful for what we've got, because we all have a date.
Yeah. Gerald, I know this is probably your first interview you've done in years. I know you've been approached several times. I appreciate it, man. Like, I've been as respectful as possible. I've also looked into your background and what was going on with it. And I can tell you, like, if I had any concerns in regards to your character, we wouldn't be talking right now. Like, I know there's some issues there. You paid the price for it. Who am I to sit here and say, I'm not piling on. I'm not piling on anybody. And the one major concern I had, I'm pretty shocked that it went down the way it did.
Yeah, but it's over. It's over. It's gone. I'm okay.
Yeah, I've seen it before. Like, it's not often you see it, but when it happens, it happens. Yeah, it is. Are you suing?
No, they're probably doing the best they can. And those detectives and those judges and DAs, they're probably just doing the best they can with the information that's in front of them. And I don't spend time wishing ill will on them. I don't think that they're wishing
ill will on me. You have the ability to sue.
Yeah. And I don't, man. I'm going fishing.
Fuck. Wow. Wow. I'm sure you've turned on a few lawyers contacting you in regards to it.
Yeah. But you know what? It's over. I'm okay. It's over. It's over. I've got a wonderful girlfriend now. And my life is very good. The rest of my day is going to be a wonderful Sunday.
Yep. That's good. Gerald, man, I truly appreciate this. Thank you so much. You have not dodged any single topic. There's not a single thing that you dodged in this.
Yeah.
People are going to be in the comments saying different things. I would suggest you ignore it, man.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I appreciate it, man. It was good. We'll do it again, Gerald, anytime.
100%, dude. Absolutely, man. I'll shoot you a text. Thanks so much, Gerald. And I'm going to send you something else in the mail. I'll get you a t-shirt, nice little package and stuff like that I do for everybody. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. See you, Mike. All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Be good. Well, that concludes our interview with Gerald Strebent. And I'm going to tell you guys a very, very special thank you to Hong Kong Fui over at MixedMartialArts.com for connecting us. He's actually been reaching out to fighters left and right. And this one, obviously, took a little while to piece it together, but it came through. And, dude, thank you. HKP, seriously, thank you so much. We appreciate all your help, especially pinning our threads to the top of MixedMartialArts.com on the Underground Forum. So, Andrew Mendoza, what'd you think of the interview?
Dude, the interview was good, man. I think a lot of people are going to learn a lot of new things about this guy. And look, with the amount of events that happened in this guy's life, I mean, you could have made a movie easily.
Yeah. I mean, in his highs are higher than anything that we could imagine in regards to, we had talked about earlier being a chef of the Rubber Guard, hanging out with Joe Rogan. And this is before Rogan became Rogan, and the Rubber Guard is now in about 150 different establishments around the world.
Right.
And then look at his lowest of lows. I mean, murder, child issues. Like, you couldn't have a higher high, and it's difficult to find a figure out a lower than low.
Yeah. It's real unfortunate, man. Like, you know, just because his name is tagged with, you know, a lot of the issues he had, like he couldn't open up a gym, and if he wanted to, he couldn't become a coach, you know, and it's unfortunate, man.
Yeah, it really is. And like, you know, Google and all the search engines, like the guy's been around the world training with some of the greatest like practitioners, and he's got this knowledge, and now he can't share it. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. I mean, the guy's fought with, you know, just about the who's who, you know, in MMA, and he's trained with them as well, you know, not just mid-level people. He's, you know, with the elite, you know.
Yeah. So just so you guys know, this guy right here is responsible for all the timestamps. We have not burned him out yet. I think it's right around the corner. But this is Andrew Mendoza. Andrew handles all of the timestamps. He keeps us organized. So, like, Andrew, he and I kind of go back and forth in regards to, like, whenever we're prepping for a future guest, we always try to figure out what's in the library, and his timestamps help with that. So a lot of our questions are actually, like, the insider information that we get from our own interviews. So now we're kind of, you know, going through stories that we've already heard. We're either confirming or kind of opening up or expanding those avenues of discussion. And we can't do that without like our timestamps. So greatly appreciated, Andrew.
Anytime, man. You know, I just hope that anybody that's listening to the interview, if you listen to it from the beginning to right now, you know, I hope you do have a second opinion on the guy. Gerald, I mean, I don't think he has evil intentions. You know, he did what he did, but we got to listen to his perspective as well. You know, you can't just go based off of everybody on the internet, because, you know, it's not always going to be true information.
Well, that's super important. So when you and I had discussed, you know, Joey Venti as well, we were in those discussions in regards to how this interview is going to lay out. The one thing that all of us said is we got to let him talk. Like, there's not going to be bah, 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 just hammering a guest like certain interviews do. It's, you're going to let him talk. Some of the things you're going to like what he says, some of the things you're not going to like what he says. But at the end of the day, these are his words. They're from him. Like when he nonchalantly said, yeah, I put a bullet in the middle of his head. I don't see that situation playing out any different. Like, that's some hardcore shit right there, man. That's some hardcore stuff right there. You know?
Yeah, he's not afraid to talk about any subject.
No. And like to push it forward, he puts his address online. Like, hey man, you got something to say to me? Just come to my house. And based on his background, you know, those internet tough guys that are leaving comments right now, literally right now, that are in the comment section, man, go to his house. Go have a conversation with him.
Yeah. Or just leave the negativity out.
Or leave the negativity out. You know what I mean? But here's the thing. Like, some people will hide behind a screen name. And, you know, I've been guilty of it. I'm not going to lie. You know, kind of talking a little bit of trash. He's willing to have a discussion with you in person. And a lot of people in his situation are not willing to do that.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, Andrew, man. You know, he's the people he was around, man. It's just unfortunate that they're not reaching out. And
I hope they do. Even if it's just to check in, say hello, miss you, you know, something like that. That means the world to somebody. On top of that, just so like there's no misunderstandings of like where we're going. In the past, I've tried to get Brett Rogers and I've tried to get Hermes Franca. Now, what they have been involved in outside of the ring is pretty horrific stuff, but they're part of history. They deserve to have a voice. Both said no. It is what it is, you know, and it's like I'm not here to judge. I'm just here to have a conversation. So if you guys are into listening to people speak, cool. If you want to hear somebody yell at somebody for the sake of yelling at somebody, man, you got to go somewhere else. I mean, and you probably are anyway.
Yeah.
At this point in the interview, you probably unsubscribed and left. But dude, it is what it is. I mean, it is what it is. That's not what we're all about.
So, yeah, man. And another thing too, the whole Rafael Torre situation, you know, it was interesting hearing it from his perspective and hearing how he thinks the outcome, like, hey, well, technically that didn't really prove much.
But and you know, man,
I like hearing it from his perspective.
You know, like, you know, attorneys are listening to this and dude, they never charged Angel Richardson. Like,
yeah.
Huge red flag.
Yeah.
So either way, ladies and gentlemen, let's just say you like this or you didn't like this and you're still listening right now. You got to leave us a review on iTunes. Like, we're at like the top 20% of podcasts. Like period, but the hill, that mountain to climb at this point is pretty steep. And the only way we get there is with a little bit of help, a like, share, and a subscribe. So like, if you're listening at this point right now and you've never liked, shared, or subscribed our stuff, man, dude, like, I've got a lot of words for you, but I'm not gonna say it. I'm gonna be like, you know, the comment section of Gerald Strebent for the negativity. I'm gonna let that ride out.
Yeah.
So Andrew, dude, always a pleasure. Thanks, man. I sincerely appreciate all your help with the podcast, bro.
Check out the full interview on iTunes, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.